Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here, and my colleague, Jared McLean, one of the litigation counsel here at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, has joined us for this segment to talk about a recent ruling from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in the case Malise v. Consumer Product Safety Commission. And for regular listeners of the program, you may recall that Lisa Malise is a client of NCLA and that she sued the CPSC over the new rule that they had on bath seats because the rule was promulgated behind a paywall. And so there's no way for consumers to see the rule without paying more to see the rule than the cost of the bath seat in the first place. And we have a very, NCLA thinks there's a serious due process problem with hiding the law behind paywalls. And so here to tell us what the D.C. Circuit decided is Jared McLean. Jared, welcome to Administrative Static.
Hey, happy to be back.
Well, so maybe we should just begin. Can you tell folks what the D.C. Circuit's ruling was in the case, and then we can go into some more details?
Yeah, so not to get too technical, but the way that CPSC issues these rules is by something called direct final rulemaking. And essentially, the agency publishes this notice to the public to say, we're going to revise this safety standard for a child product, and you have 60 days to comment to let us know whether or not you think there's a problem with the standard, and then we'll take 30 days to review those comments, and if we have not filed a separate notice revoking the rule, then the rule will become final.
And so, I remember that NCLA filed comments in this case. I think it was in November of 2019. Am I remembering the timeline correctly? Which was within that 60-day window, right?
That's correct. And when NCLA published their comment, it gets filed on regulation.gov, so any member of the public who is following the rulemaking process could see that NCLA has filed this 15-page objection to the standard and raised a lot of constitutional arguments about why CPSC should not go forward with its rulemaking process. And so anyone who would watch that would think, okay, well, I need to wait this next 30 days to see whether the agency is going to take this comment seriously and withdraw its rule.
Right. And so I think I said November, but actually it was the end of October, I think, that NCLA filed the comments. So because the comments were due within 30 days, but you're saying that there's a 60-day window for these final rules.
No, you were right the first time. So
it's
a 90-day total window, 60-day comment period, and then 30-day review.
So
we filed in November, and then the rule would have become final in December if there were not adverse comments. And so what the agency says is, if there's no adverse comments, we will make this rule final, and on this date in December, it will be deemed published in the Federal Register. So that is letting everyone know that if you don't hear anything from us by December, this will become a final rule and will be the new safety standard that applies to all infant bath seats.
And now what I recall from our comments, we said something along the lines of there's a problem putting these rules behind paywalls. And we think this is such a significant problem that the agency should treat this as adverse commentary or adverse comment and pull the rule.
That's absolutely correct. And we told the agency that the only way that they could cure the problem that we identified in their rule was to withdraw the rule.
Okay.
And so anyone in the public who's looking on would see that and say, oh, well, maybe this rule's not going to go into effect after all. Let me wait this 30-day period to see whether CPSC takes a look at this comment and withdraws the rule like it should, because it doesn't even necessarily have to agree with us to think that it's adverse. The rule is just if it's adverse, the rule comes down. The agency doesn't have to think we're absolutely correct. It just has to think that it's adverse. So it's a pretty soft showing that we think that our 15 pages of constitutional law arguments easily met.
And then if they were to have taken down the rule, they wouldn't even necessarily have to change the rule, but they would have to respond to those comments in some form or fashion before the rule would go into effect. Is that how it works, or how it should work?
That's absolutely correct, because normally when an agency goes through a rulemaking process, it's more of a two-step process. The agency asks for comments, and then it responds to them, and then it issues the final rule. And CPSC says, well, this rule isn't controversial, and we're not expecting adverse comments, so we're going to consolidate those two steps into a single step, and the rule will be tentative unless we receive adverse comments. And where that left us was we waited the 90 days, and then the statute gives us 60 days from when the rule becomes final to file our lawsuit. And on behalf of Lisa Melisse, NCLA filed its lawsuit within that 60-day period. And there were a lot of procedural things that went on in the case, and it gets kicked around. It gets transferred to the D.C. Circuit. This all takes about a year and a half. The panel for argument gets announced. We're preparing for argument, and a week out from argument, ASTM, the private company that created the safety standard that's hidden behind a paywall, files a letter with the court and says, you know, we think that the 60-day clock should have began running in October when the agency first announced that it was considering this rule, rather than beginning in December when the rule went into effect.
So in other words, the clock would expire 30 days before you even knew whether the agency believed it had received adverse comment or not?
Correct. That's the precise problem that we tried to identify for the D.C. Circuit about how, as a practical matter, ASTM's interpretation of when the clock should have run makes no sense, because as a concerned parent, Lisa Melisse is watching this process and seeing what's going to happen with this safety standard, and there's concerns about the fact that this standard isn't freely available to the public. And if the clock begins running in October, before you even know whether the agency is going to act on an adverse comment, and before you know whether the rule is going to become final, you would have to file a lawsuit in the D.C. Circuit to challenge the rule, and that lawsuit might end up becoming moot as soon as you file it. And I'll just say, this is a case about free access to the law. Filing a lawsuit in the D.C. Circuit costs $500. So in order to preserve your right to challenge what CPSC is doing here, before you even know if you have to file a lawsuit, you need to preemptively spend $500 just to preserve your rights.
Well, that sounds outrageous. So did the D.C. Circuit see it that way and agree with you?
The D.C. Circuit did not see it that way. The D.C. Circuit, without any mention of the practical implications of its decision and all the things that we discussed in our 90 minutes of oral argument before the court, it said that traditionally
I should just, for our listeners, Jared, I just want to point out, that's pretty unusual to have an oral argument go that long. They really dug in at the oral argument and asked a ton of questions. And so I do want to at least give the court credit for the amount of time that they obviously spent wrestling with this issue and asking tons of questions. I think let you say your piece at the oral argument. But please continue with the problem with what they decided.
No, that's right. And I do want to give them credit for how much they were concerned about this at oral argument. And I should note, too, that this was the first federal court of appeals decision to ever consider how this direct final rulemaking process worked. And that's part of why argument went on so long and why it was so difficult to convince the court, because there's no cases out there telling the court what it should do. And in the absence of those cases...
And isn't it also true, Jared, that there's no law out there specifying that agencies are allowed to do direct final rules?
That agencies decided for themselves that they're allowed to do direct final rules.
Yeah.
And so in the absence of any decisions or statutes or anything explaining how these direct final rules should work, what the D.C. Circuit did was revert back to how it traditionally handles the rulemaking process, which I mentioned before is usually a two-step process with clearly delineated comment periods and finality. And typically, the effective date of a rule does not matter for finality. Like an agency will promulgate a rule and say, okay, this is final now, but it's not going to go into effect for a year, so the industry has time to catch up and change its manufacturing or what have you. And in the direct final rulemaking process, the effective date collapses with the date that the rule becomes final. So from a parent's standpoint, they don't know what the safety standard is going to be and don't know whether they have to file the lawsuit. But from the manufacturer's standpoint, they don't know whether they're going to need to start manufacturing these bath seats differently until the day the rule becomes effective. And so the direct final rulemaking process is problematic for a number of reasons, and we think that the way that the court should have handled this was to say the rule is not final until its effective date, and people like Lisa Melise who want to challenge this rule are able to take an additional 60 days after finality to decide whether or not they're going to sue. But now, in order to fight for her right to see the law for free, Lisa has to file $500 lawsuit before ever even knowing whether the agency is going to take her concern seriously.
Yeah, it's a really disappointing result from the D.C. Circuit. We're almost out of time, Jared, but if you can quickly explain, it sounds like if she had filed the original comments, which NCLA filed, and her name was not on those comments, that the result might have been slightly different?
Possibly. And the court didn't rule definitively, but the D.C. Circuit has a rule where if you personally raise an objection to an agency rulemaking process, the statute of limitations effectively is told for you individually. So Lisa would have had her own private extension of the time to file that wouldn't have worked for anyone else in the country.
Right, including NCLA in this case.
Correct.
Thank you very much, Jared. Appreciate you being with us to tell us more about this bad result.
Hi, this is Harriet Hageman again with the New Civil Liberties Alliance out of Washington, D.C., and we're going to be talking today about the RCAF versus USDA matter. This is an interesting lawsuit that we have filed in the United States District Court for the District of Wyoming. It actually involves what was described as a fact sheet that was issued by the United States Department of Agriculture in April 2019. One day, just out of nowhere, there appeared a document on the USDA website, a short document, 2 pages, and it stated that all livestock producers who wanted to move their livestock across state lines would be required to start using radio frequency identification ear tags. This was unbeknownst to most of the livestock industry that this was going to be coming out. It was quite a surprise to many people for a variety of reasons, including the fact that the cost to the industry would be well over $2 billion, and that's according to the USDA estimates. So we were contacted by some ranchers out of South Dakota and Wyoming, and they said this just seemed to be such an odd thing for the USDA to be issuing, in part because in 2013, the USDA had actually issued a final rule related to animal identification and traceability, requiring or stating that our livestock producers could use all forms of traditional types of identification, including brands and back tags, tattoos, group identification numbers, ear tags, including radio frequency or RFID ear tags, and other forms of identification in order to identify and trace their livestock. So in 2013, the final rule provided for flexibility. It allowed for low-cost type of technology to be used, the traditional types of technology that livestock producers have been using to identify their cattle for literally hundreds of years now. In 2019, the fact sheet changed all of that. So in October of 2019, NCLA filed a lawsuit on behalf of an organization called RCAF USA and four ranchers, Kenny and Roxy Fox out of South Dakota, and Donna and Tracy Hunt out of Newcastle, Wyoming. The nature of our lawsuit
I like
was
to call this our Fox Hunt litigation.
Our Fox Hunt litigation. That's exactly right, Mark. And we filed that on, I believe it was October 5th, and by the end of the month, the USDA actually withdrew that offending fact sheet. Obviously, the USDA realized that they were on shaky ground, that they didn't have the legal authority to mandate all livestock producers in the United States to use RFID technology, and they withdrew that fact sheet. The problem was, however, the mechanism and the manner by which USDA had moved forward with that document in the first place. And what we found is that USDA had put together a group of, we would call it an advisory committee of people who were all like-minded with USDA.
In fact, they had a federal advisory committee even.
A federal advisory committee. And they had two such federal advisory committees. The first one was called the Cattle Traceability Working Group, and that had some people who were naysayers. And those folks said, we don't want RFID. It's going to be too expensive. It's not feasible. It is unnecessary. It's a form of government surveillance. And they had numerous different objections to the USDA moving forward with this kind of technology. So the USDA, doing what it typically does, was they then formed a second federal advisory committee and got rid of all the naysayers. And lo and behold, the new advisory committee came back and said, we think we ought to go forward with RFID. The problem with that approach was, under the Federal Advisory Committee Act, federal agencies are not allowed to do what they did here. They are not allowed to just take one side of the argument and have those folks advise them and then go forward with a guidance document or a rulemaking or anything else.
You can have a federal advisory committee. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you have one, it can't be stacked in the way that the second committee was stacked. And even the first committee is a problem because under the Federal Advisory Committee Act, you have to have open meetings, you have to take minutes. There's lots of obligations that fall on having an official advisory committee that weren't met by either one of these committees, as I understand it.
Well, that's absolutely true. Under FACA, it's just simply a transparency statute. And what it is that we as citizens of the United States, as the governed, we are entitled to know what our agencies are doing, what our public servants are doing. And so it's a good governance statute. And what it requires is, as Mark said, that you have to meet a variety of obligations if you're going to have an advisory committee so that the citizens of this country can participate. So both committees violated the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And as a result, even though USDA had withdrawn the offending fact sheet, we still have all of the work product associated from those two advisory committees. And USDA has come out and very clearly stated that they do intend to go forward with an RFID mandate. They want to do it pursuant to a formal rulemaking. But what we've been concerned about is that they will use the work product from those advisory committees to just come up with another rulemaking mandating RFID. So in the spring of 2020, we filed an amended complaint against USDA and one of its sub-agencies called APHIS, and we're challenging their work and their conduct and their violation of FACA or the Federal Advisory Committee Act.
So why shouldn't they be able to use all of that work that they put in already? What's the reason for not letting them use that?
Well, it's kind of the concept of the fruit of the poisonous tree. I realize that that's a concept in a criminal context under the Fourth Amendment. But the idea is that an agency should not be allowed to violate the law and then say, oh, okay, well, no harm, no foul. We'll just go ahead and we'll go forward doing it the right way this time. But we're going to use all of the information and documentation and data and statistics and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that was generated by the committees that violated the law.
So it's a deterrent. It's the only way to enforce it, or the only way to make people follow FACA is to have some real consequences if they don't.
Absolutely. It is a deterrent. And in this case, it's very important because the cattle industry, primarily the folks who actually raise cattle, were really excluded from these advisory committees. And keep in mind, an RFID mandate requiring ear tags on cattle, it is the cattle industry that will be required to comply with that. So USDA and APHIS, not only did they come out with a mandate on RFID with a bunch of people who will benefit from that, they excluded the people who will suffer for those decisions. So it's a deterrent, but it's also important that USDA hear from the actual cattle producers. I grew up on a ranch out here in Wyoming, and we have pastures that may be several thousand acres big. The feasibility associated with RFID ear tags is something that has been of great concern to our cattle producers because there are potential criminal consequences associated with not following the law. Another important aspect is that if you don't have RFID, according to the fact sheet that they issued in the spring of 2019, you're not allowed to sell your livestock. So you could literally put somebody out of business in a matter of months if they're not able to use the technology that has been that's been forced upon them by a federal agency. What was also important is that these advisory committees were dominated by folks such as those who represented the ear tag community. That may surprise you, Mark, but in fact, one of the chairs of the committee was a representative from an electronic ear tag manufacturing company.
It's shocking in one sense, but it's the reason why the FACA law exists is to prevent this kind of committee stacking, because of course the government is going to put people on the committee who already agree with the position that the government wants to take. If they're allowed to get away with doing that, that's what they're going to do every time. And so that's why FACA exists and why it should be enforced in this case, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And the other real strong advocates for it are the Packers. And again, the Packers are not the ones that are going to suffer the consequences of either having to run your cattle through a chute, handle them, do this, and use this kind of an identification. And they're not the ones that are going to have to suffer the costs associated with placing RFID ear tags on every head of livestock that you own. So, you know, some of these producers, they may have 800, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 head of cattle, some even more. And what RFID or what USDA is going to require is that every one of those go in and handle their livestock and place ear tags on them. So, you know, again, it came out of the blue. It was developed in a back room between USDA and folks who want to force our livestock industry, primarily our cattle producers, into using RFID ear tags. So we filed the lawsuit, the amended complaint, and at the same time that we filed that amended complaint, we also did a FOIA request to USDA. So we not only had the lawsuit pending, but we sent them a Freedom of Information Act request. What was very interesting is that when the USDA, as a result of our lawsuit, produced their administrative record related to the RFID requirements, they didn't include a lot of the documents that we ultimately received under our FOIA request. So while under the law, they are required to produce all documents associated with the development of that fact sheet, we ultimately learned that they were withholding quite a few incredibly important documents related to our FACA claims. Because the real issue is, did the agencies either establish or utilize these advisory committees? What USDA would say was, well, yeah, we met with them and we talked to them and we thought it would be a good idea to use RFID, but we're not the ones who told them what to do. We just sat in the back of the room and we didn't tell them what to do. We didn't have anything to do with it, blah, 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 blah. But we found from the FOIA documents that that was not the case. In the FOIA documents, we received quite a few emails demonstrating that USDA and APHIS were right smack in the middle of every aspect of these advisory committees and developing the RFID requirements.
So we only have about a minute left or less than a minute. Can you explain where the case sits right now?
Well, the judge disagreed with us, and she refused to, the federal district court judge has refused to allow us to do discovery on USDA on those particular issues. We are now up on appeal to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and we are going to be pursuing these FACA claims at the appellate level at the 10th Circuit in Denver. Our briefing schedule will be starting in August.
All right. Terrific. Well, thank you so much for sitting in again this week, Harriet. Really appreciate having you on board with Administrative Static.
Thank you.